Let's go on to chapter 18, liver pathology. We'll start off talking briefly about jaundice. Clinically, jaundice usually occurs when the bilirubin levels get over 2 to 3. Classic presentation, patient will come in having yellow skin and scleral icterus. Let's talk about some of the causes of jaundice. I'd like to refer to table 18-1, unconjugated versus conjugated bilirubinemias. Let's start with the unconjugated or indirect bilirubinemias. The big ones in this category are increased RBC turnover, for example, the hemolytic anemias. Next is newborn children, especially premature children. They tend to develop with physiologic jaundice of the newborns. The next one on the unconjugated category is the hereditary types, Gilbert syndrome and Krigler-Najar syndromes. Let's look at the column for conjugated or direct bilirubinemias. For this category, biliary tract obstruction is important. Primary sclerosing cholangitis and biliary cirrhosis is also important. In the hereditary category, you got to remember Dubin-Johnson and Roeder syndrome. And finally, liver disease will also give you a conjugated bilirubinemia. Let's go on to talk about increased RBC turnover. By definition, the red cells are turning over very rapidly. In this category, they tend to give you a patient who's got a hemolytic anemia, someone who's got sickle cell or thalassemia. And what do they develop? They develop an unconjugated bilirubinemia. The next category that they ask about commonly are the hereditary types. In specific, I want to talk about Dubin-Johnson syndrome. Board loves this one. It's an autosomal recessive disorder. It's caused by a decreased bilirubin excretion due to a defect in catalicular transport. The protein that usually transports the bilirubin from the hepatocyte into the bile duct is defective. So they develop what's called a conjugated hyperbilirubinemia. Now, why does the board love this one? Because the liver turns a black color. So if they give you a biopsy of the liver and it's jet black, you want to think of Dubin-Johnson's. Okay, last thing I want you to know about Dubin-Johnson's is there really is no clinical significance. They just develop bouts of jaundice, especially when they become stressed. Okay, let's talk about biliary tract obstruction. Remember the etiologies. In the United States, gallstones, most common cause. Other causes are cancer, especially pancreatic cancer, gallbladder cancer, and bile duct cancer. Strictures are another big cause, and if they come from Asia, you want to think about parasites, for instance, Chlornocus. Let's move on to the presentation. They tend to present with jaundice. They can have scleral icterus. They also tend to have a lot of itching because of the increased plasma levels of bile acids. They can have abdominal pain, fevers, chills. The urine tends to become dark because of the bilirubinuria. And finally, they can develop pale, clay-colored stools because you have obstruction of the biliary tract. Let's look at the laboratory. They have an elevated conjugated bilirubinemia. They also have an elevation in alkaline phosphatase and 5' nucleotidase. Okay, let's move on to primary biliary cirrhosis. For this one, I want you to remember that it's an inflammatory disease of the bile ducts. There's also granulomatous destruction of the bile ducts as well. It tends to occur in females because we think it's an autoimmune-related disease. The presentation is classic, tends to be middle-aged females. They develop obstructive jaundice. They develop itching. They develop increased serum cholesterol. They can develop xanthomas and xanthelasma as a result. They can also develop cirrhosis as a late complication, biliary cirrhosis. When you look at the laboratory, they have an elevated conjugated bilirubinemia. They also have elevations in alk-phos and 5' nucleotidase because the bile ducts are being destroyed. The thing that's characteristic about this disease is they produce an autoantibody against mitochondria. They call those AMAs, anti-mitochondrial antibodies. Those are present in 90% of patients. Last thing I want you to remember is these patients tend to have other autoimmune diseases. They can have scleroderma, they can have rheumatoid arthritis, they can have lupus erythematosum. Let's go on to primary sclerosing cholangitis. For this one, I want you to remember it occurs in males, much more common than females. And the majority of cases are associated with ulcerative colitis. What will you see microscopically? You tend to see concentric fibrosis surrounding the bile ducts. Last thing is, if they do a cholangiogram, the bile ducts tend to have a characteristic beaded appearance. Okay, let's move on to a five-star topic, cirrhosis. This is a board favorite. Remember that cirrhosis is an end-stage liver disease. It's characterized by destruction of the normal parenchyma by bands of fibrosis. It breaks the liver up into nodules of regenerating hepatic parenchyma. Now let's look at the etiology. In the United States, alcohol by far is the most common cause. The next common cause are the hepatitis viruses. Other less common causes are biliary tract disease, hemochromatosis, Wilson's disease, and alpha-1 antitrypsin. Now let's look at the gross. For the gross, we divide cirrhosis into two types depending on the size of the nodules. If the nodules are smaller than 3 millimeters, we call it micronodular. If it's greater than 3 millimeters, we call it macronodular. Why is that distinction important? Because it gives you an idea of what the etiology is. Micronodular cirrhosis tends to be associated with metabolic diseases like alcohol, hemochromatosis, alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. Macronodular cirrhosis tends to be inflammatory diseases like viral hepatitis or destruction of liver by toxins like mushroom poisoning, carbon tetrachloride, and so forth. Okay, let's talk about the mechanism. Why does the liver become fibrotic? Well, it's usually due to the Edo cell. It's the stellate cell within the liver. And that's the cell that's responsible for laying down all the collagen and creating the fibrosis. Let's go on and talk about the consequences. The consequences of cirrhosis you'll see in the clinical vignette. The patients will present with portal hypertension. They'll have ascites. They'll have large spleens and liver as a result of the backup of all the fluid. A serious complication is esophageal varices. If these rupture, the patients will present with vomiting up blood in large amounts. They can also develop hemorrhoids, and they can develop dilated veins on the chest wall, especially on the abdomen. We call that capita medusa. Let's go on to the other complications. Because the liver is now damaged, you have decreased detoxification. As a consequence, these patients tend to develop hepatic encephalopathy. They will present with what's called a liver flap. When you ask them to extend their hand, hyperextend their hand, they can't do it. Their hand will flap like this. They call that asterixis. It's a classic sign of hepatic encephalopathy. Because they can't detoxify estrogens, they tend to develop gynecomastia, spider angiomas, and palmar erythema as well. Another complication is decreased synthesis of various proteins. Since they don't synthesize albumin, they can develop ascites and edema. Since they don't produce many clotting factors, eventually they can develop a coagulopathy and have elevations of PT and PTT. The final complication is called the hepatorenal syndrome. No one really understands why, but once the liver starts to fail, the kidneys will commonly fail as well. We call that the hepatorenal syndrome. Okay, let's move on now to the viral hepatitises. For the viral hepatitises, I want you to remember that the clinical presentation tends to be the same no matter which of the viruses infects the patient. They all look about the same. For the acute patients, they can be asymptomatic. They can have general malaise. They can have anorexia. They can become jaundiced or have urine that may be dark. On laboratory exam, they tend to have an elevation in the transaminases, an elevation of AST and ALT. How do you make the diagnosis? How do you tell all the different viral hepatitises apart? You gotta use serology to make the ultimate diagnosis. Now, under the microscope, they all look the same. So let's talk about acute viral hepatitis. By definition, these patients have signs and symptoms that are less than 6 months in duration. If you took a biopsy of the liver, all the viruses look the same. You'll see lobular disarray. You'll see damage to the hepatocytes characterized by swelling. They call that ballooning of the hepatocytes. You'll see inflammation, especially with lymphocytes. They tend to come into the portal tract. They can also be found in the parenchyma as well. You'll see, viral processes produce apoptosis. So you'll see lots of councilman bodies, apoptotic hepatocytes. And the final thing you'll see is the liver trying to regenerate itself. So you'll see hepatocytes regenerating. Let's talk about chronic viral hepatitis. For chronic viral hepatitis, by definition, the signs and symptoms have a duration that is greater than 6 months. Which viruses cause chronic hepatitis? Well, it's only viruses B, C, and D. Those are the only three. Under the microscope, there's two major types of chronic hepatitis. We divide into chronic persistent hepatitis, where all the inflammation is only in the portal tracts, and the other type is called chronic active hepatitis, where now the inflammation is spilling out into the parenchyma. Those are the two major types. Now let's look at an example of cirrhosis. Let's go to the slide. And here's an example of a cirrhotic liver. And what you want to do whenever you see one of these pictures is off at the side, there's usually a ruler, and you want to figure out whether this is micronodular or macronodular. So if you take a look at some of these nodules, they're pretty small. I'm circling one now. I'll circle another one now. They're about 2 to maybe 3 millimeters in size, so I would characterize this cirrhosis as a micronodular cirrhosis. In the United States, the most common cause of micronodular cirrhosis by far is alcohol. Another thing you should notice about this picture is what color is the liver. Normal liver tends to be a nice dark brown color. These nodules tend to look actually a little more yellow brown. That's the fatty change from all the alcohol. Okay, let's move on to another five-star topic. The board loves to talk about viral hepatitis. So let's talk about the hepatitis viruses. Okay. First thing I want you to remember is the clinical presentation. All the viruses tend to present in a similar fashion. They tend to be asymptomatic in many cases. Other cases, they'll have general malaise, fatigue, anorexia. They can have bouts of jaundice. Their urine may actually turn dark. On laboratory exam, they tend to have an elevation in ALT and AST. How do you make the ultimate diagnosis? You got to do serology. Look for the different markers for the various viruses. Now, let's talk about the difference between acute viral hepatitis versus chronic viral hepatitis. For the acute viral hepatitis, by definition, you're having signs and symptoms for less than 6 months. Now, any of the hepatitis viruses can give you acute hepatitis. If they did a biopsy of the liver, you would see the following. The lobule is in disarray. You'll see damaged hepatocytes, which are swollen. We call that ballooning of the hepatocytes. You'll see inflammation, especially lymphocytes within the portal tracts and also spilling out into the lobule as well. Next thing you'll see in all viral processes, especially with hepatitis viruses, you will see apoptosis of the hepatocytes. An apoptotic hepatocyte is called a councilman body. It's just a fancy name. Last two things you'll see are hepatic regeneration, and you'll also see cholestasis as well. Now let's move on to chronic viral hepatitis. In contrast, the patient will have had signs and symptoms for more than 6 months of duration. It tends to be caused by only three of the viruses, B, C, and D. Those are the only ones. If you did a liver biopsy, there are two forms of chronic hepatitis. The first form is called chronic persistent hepatitis. You will see inflammation with lymphocytes, which is only located in the portal tract. When the inflammation starts to spill over into the parenchyma, we call that chronic active hepatitis. And the area where it's spilling over, we call that piecemeal necrosis. It's just a form of chronic hepatitis. It means that the virus is actively proliferating. Okay, let's now turn our attention to table number 18-2 and look at the individual hepatitis viruses. We'll start off with hepatitis. Actually, let's start off with looking at the different types of viruses. They are all RNA viruses with one exception, hepatitis B. It's a DNA virus. Let's look at the forms of transmission. I want you to notice that A and E are transmitted via the fecal-oral route. The way I remember this is A and E are vowels. They are transmitted by the bowels. That's the way I remember it. Let's move on to the other viruses. Hepatitis B is transmitted by sexual intercourse and also by parenteral means. Okay, any bodily fluid can transmit it. Hepatitis C tends to be mostly parenteral in the United States. Can also be sexual, but that's much less common. Let's talk about the onset. Hepatitis A tends to be abrupt in onset, but it's quite variable. Hepatitis B, on the other hand, tends to be very insidious. It can go on to chronic hepatitis very commonly. Hepatitis C is also insidious. Hepatitis D tends to be very virulent, very abrupt in onset. Same thing with hepatitis E. Let's move on to chronicity or carrier state. Which one has a chronic, can give you chronic hepatitis? Remember, B can, C can, and D can. Let's look at the clinical diseases. Which virus can give you acute hepatitis? They all can. Which virus gives you chronic hepatitis? B, C, and D. Which can give you cirrhosis? Again, it's B, C, and D. And finally, which can give you hepatocellular carcinoma? You got to remember B and C most commonly. Now, I want to say one thing about hepatitis D virus. The things that they've asked in the past is, which is worse, a superinfection with hepatitis V or a co-infection with hepatitis D? And I just want to remind you that hepatitis D, D stands for Delta, D also stands for defective. You cannot get hepatitis D unless you already have hepatitis B. Okay, and there's two ways you can get hepatitis D. You can get it at the same time as you get hepatitis B, so you get B and D together. We call that co-infection. Or you can have a patient who already has B, and then you superimpose upon it D. Which is worse? The superinfection is much, much worse. More likely to have fulminant hepatitis, more likely to go on to end-stage liver disease. Okay, for the laboratory, the board really loves to give you the serology, so you got to know the serology for each disease. Let's move on to table 18.3 and talk about the serology for hepatitis B. There's a number of different antigens I want you to know about. Hepatitis surface antigen, hepatitis C antigen, and hepatitis B virus DNA. Those are all markers of acute infection. Okay, if you find the antigen, that means that the virus is there. It's proliferating. They must have an acute infection. Some other markers I want you to pay attention to is IgG against hepatitis S and surface. Actually, let me illustrate it on table 18.5. It'll make it a little more clear. If they want you to diagnose somebody who has an acute infection, notice that what will be positive are the antigens and the hepatitis B virus DNA. The other thing that will be positive is IgM to hepatitis core. Let's look at prior infection. If somebody had hepatitis B and are now cured, the patient will have hepatitis core antibodies for IgG. They'll also have hepatitis surface antibodies for IgG. The important thing about the surface antibody for IgG, that is the antibody that's protective. Once you form that antibody, your body clears the virus and you are immune forever. So what do you do when you immunize somebody? You're trying to raise that antibody. So in immunization, that's the only antibody that'll be elevated. Last thing I want you to take a look at is in chronic infection. If the person has a chronic ongoing infection, you'll see two things. First, you'll see IgG to hepatitis core. The other thing you'll see is you'll see one of the antigens, either the surface antigen, the E antigen, or hepatitis B virus DNA. Okay, the virus is there, it's actively replicating. Okay, let's go to hepatitis A serology. This one's actually really easy. If they give you a patient who has IgM against hepatitis A, they must have an active or recent infection. On the other hand, if it's an IgG antibody, that means they've had a prior infection or they're now immunized. Okay, let's move on to alcoholic liver disease. Very important in the United States. Three major changes or diseases that you should focus on. The first is called fatty change. The other term for this is steatosis. It's a totally reversible change. If you abstain from drinking, the liver will return to normal. If you take a look at the liver grossly, it tends to be enlarged, it tends to be greasy, and it tends to be yellow in color. Microscopically, the hepatocytes will be dilated, and within the cytoplasm, you will see macrovesicles of fat. We call that macrovesicular steatosis. Now, over time, if you have persistence of fatty change, you can start to develop fibrosis, especially around the central vein. This change is irreversible when it occurs. Let's continue now with alcoholic liver disease. We'll talk about alcoholic hepatitis. This usually occurs following a bout of binge drinking, especially heavy binge drinking. Clinically, it's quite variable. It ranges from having no symptoms to having right upper quadrant severe pain, liver enlargement, jaundice, and ultimately fulminant liver failure. Microscopically, if you did a biopsy, the liver is becoming injured by the alcohol, so the hepatocytes will swell. We call that ballooning change. The other thing you'll see is within the cytoplasm of many of the hepatocytes, you'll see an accumulation of protein. We call that Mallory's hyaline. It has this nice pink amorphous appearance. And it's basically an accumulation of an intermediate filament called cytokeratin. The next change you'll see is you'll see neutrophils. They tend to come in and surround areas of necrosis. And finally, since they're drinking, the liver tends to be fatty. You'll see macrovesicular steatosis. Let's talk about the prognosis now. Each episode of alcoholic hepatitis has about a 20% risk of mortality. Also remember that each bout increases your risk of developing cirrhosis. Now, the feared complication of an alcoholic is alcoholic cirrhosis. It occurs in about 15% of alcoholics. They tend to develop a micronodular cirrhosis, and the liver tends to be very fatty, as the picture I showed you just previously. Last thing I want you to remember is alcoholic cirrhosis is probably the most common cause in the United States in adults requiring liver transplants. Okay, let's move on to some of the metabolic liver diseases and talk about Wilson's disease. The other name for this is hepatolenticular degeneration. This is a genetic disorder of copper metabolism. The problem that your body has is you cannot transport copper out of the body. Therefore, it begins to accumulate in various tissues and then ultimately becomes toxic. Let's talk about the genetics. You should know it's an autosomal recessive disorder. It's on chromosome 13. It involves the WD gene. That's the gene that's responsible for transporting copper from the hepatocyte into the bile duct for excretion. Okay, on the exam, the patients tend to present in their childhood or early adolescence, most commonly. They tend to present with liver problems. They get fatty change. They get chronic hepatitis. They also develop a micronodular cirrhosis. They have problems with their eyes, especially if you did a slip lamp exam, you would notice a Kaiser-Fleischer ring. It's deposition of copper in Desmoid's membrane around the cornea. The last place that the copper tends to accumulate and cause problems is in the brain, and they develop an encephalopathy. They develop psychiatric problems, movement disorders, and so forth. How do you make the diagnosis? Well, if you look in the serum, you'll see a decrease in the level of the copper transport protein called ceruloplasmin. If you did a liver biopsy, you will also find an increase in the tissue levels of copper, That is diagnostic. How do you treat it? Usually you use chelators, or you can use a liver transplantation. Give them a new liver that doesn't have this genetic defect. Let's move on to hemochromatosis. It's another board favorite. They tend to like testing on this. By definition, you will see increased levels of iron, which increase to toxic levels and ultimately cause tissue injury. There's two forms. You can have the hereditary form or the secondary form. For the hereditary forms, I want you to remember it's a recessive disorder. It tends to involve HLA-H gene on chromosome 6. And the mechanism, why do you accumulate too much iron? It's because your GI tract absorbs too much from your diet. For the secondary forms of hemochromatosis, it's usually due to chronic transfusions. It's in patients who have chronic anemias. They require ongoing multiple transfusions. Let's look at the epidemiology. By far, men are affected much more than females. It's common in patients of Northern European descent. And finally, the distribution of disease. Iron tends to accumulate in the liver. Patients develop a micronodular cirrhosis, and they have a markedly increased risk of developing hepatocellular carcinoma. It also tends to accumulate in the pancreas. It destroys the islet cells, and these patients tend to develop diabetes. It also tends to deposit in the skin, leading to hyperpigmentation. And therefore, this disease has often been called a bronze diabetes because of the bronzing of the skin and the diabetes. And finally, it tends to affect the heart. You can develop a congestive heart failure and an anemia. Let's look at how do you make the diagnosis. Well, the serum levels of iron are going to be elevated. The serum levels of ferritin will also be increased. But what clinches the diagnosis is you need to do a tissue biopsy, usually of the liver. You stain it with the Prussian blue stain, and that will highlight all the increased iron. That's diagnostic. Okay, let's move on to alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. This is an autosomal recessive disorder. It's characterized by production of a defective alpha-1 antitrypsin. This cannot be excreted from the liver. In fact, it accumulates in the liver. The rest of the body, however, is deficient in alpha-1 antitrypsin. Let's look at the genetics. Alpha-1 antitrypsin is produced by the PI gene. It's on chromosome 14. PI stands for protease inhibitor, because that's what alpha-1 antitrypsin is. It's a protease inhibitor. Now, there are many different genetic variants of this gene. The most common form is PIM. So most people, when you look at their genetics, they're PIMM. That's what a normal person is. If you inherit the PIZ allele, however, you will have markedly decreased production of alpha-1 antitrypsin. In fact, people who have PIZZ as their genetic makeup will develop alpha-1 antitrypsin. So remember PIZZ. Okay, let's talk about the distribution of disease. Well, since the liver is accumulating all of this alpha-1 antitrypsin, it tends to become injured, and you'll develop a micronodular cirrhosis. You also have an increased risk of developing hepatocellular carcinoma as well. What else? The other organ that's classically involved on the exam is the lungs. You'll develop what's called a pan-acinar emphysema because you do not have this protease inhibitor. Okay, if you did a microscopic biopsy of the liver, within the hepatocytes, you'll see these globules of alpha-1 antitrypsin. They tend to look pink and they stain positively with PSA. Let's go on to treatment. The only treatment really is prevention of the emphysema. You want to tell the person that they must not smoke, otherwise they increase their likelihood of developing emphysema. For the liver, there's really no treatment. The only thing you can do is liver transplantation. Okay, let's move on to Reye's syndrome. This is a very rare disease, but it's potentially fatal. Usually occurs in young children who's had a viral illness, usually either influenza or chickenpox. And unfortunately, their parents give them an aspirin. In certain genetically susceptible children, they develop mitochondrial injury, and they develop fatty change within the liver, and cerebral edema, which is potentially lethal. Okay, we call that RISE syndrome. Prognosis. Most patients recover, about 3/4 have no problems. About 25% of the patients will have severe problems, though. They can have coma, they can have neurologic deficits, and they can also die as well. Okay, let's move on and talk about liver neoplasms. We'll start off with the benign tumors. Let's start off talking about hemangiomas. This is the most common primary tumor of the liver. Fortunately, they're totally benign. They're usually incidental tumors that are picked up by an incidental x-ray or CAT scan of the liver. They are a vascular tumor, so grossly, if you look at them, they have a red appearance. They tend to be very spongy. Let's talk about the next one in your handout. It's hepatic adenoma, also known as a liver cell adenoma. For this one, the board will give you a young female who's on oral contraceptives. Again, this is a benign tumor. If it occurs underneath the capsule of the liver, it has a propensity to actually rupture the capsule and cause an intraperitoneal hemorrhage. That's the classic way these patients present. Last thing I want you to remember about hepatic adenomas is if you withdraw the oral contraceptives, these tumors tend to regress. They go away. Let's move on to the malignant tumors that occur within the liver. The big one is hepatocellular carcinoma. It's the most common primary malignant tumor within a liver. Very, very common in Asia and Japan because of all the hepatitis in that area of the world. Other etiologies, any cause of cirrhosis, alcohol. And another one the board loves to ask about is aflatoxin B1. It's a toxin produced by Aspergillus. Okay, other important facts is how does hepatocellular tumors spread? They tend to spread by hematogenous means. They invade the hepatic vein. In fact, they can actually block the hepatic vein and lead to hepatic vein thrombosis. We call that the Budd-Chiari syndrome. Okay, last thing I want you to remember is tumor markers. These tumors tend to produce alpha-fetoprotein, which could be elevated in these patients. Last thing is there's one other variant. It's called the fibrolamellar variant. I want you to remember this occurs in younger patients. A lot of fibrosis, and it's got a better prognosis. So remember fibrolamellar variants. Okay, the next one in your handout is cholangiocarcinoma. Pretty uncommon tumor. I want you to remember the risk factors. In the United States, they may have been exposed to a radiologic agent called thorotrast. The other risk factor is if they come from Asia, think of liver flukes, chlorinocus. Microscopic, it's an adenocarcinoma because it arises from the biliary ducts, so it's a gland-forming tumor. It's often discovered very late in the course and has a poor prognosis. Last tumor I want to talk about is the angiosarcoma. Again, a very rare tumor. But I want you to remember, it is associated with various chemical carcinogens. The board loves to test you on the association with thorotrast, arsenic, and vinyl chloride. Okay? It's a malignant vascular tumor. It tends to be very aggressive, it can metastasize, and it's often lethal. The final tumor that you can find within the liver is a metastatic tumor. Okay? Most common primary sites, colon loves to go to the liver, lung goes to the liver, and breast. Those are the three most common. Finally, whenever you have metastatic tumors within the liver, they tend to be multifocal. So you'll see multiple nodules within the liver. That's classic for a metastatic tumor. That concludes the liver pathology section.